Well, good morning. It's a Thursday, and that means it's time for Perspectives on WFSU-FM. I'm Tom Flanagan. Thanks so much for tuning in and for being at the other end of our multitude of modern communication methodologies, such as the standard old telephone, 414-1234, the local number in the greater Tallahassee metro area. If it's long distance between you to us, it's 800-926-8809. Perspectives at WFSU.org is the email address. And if you prefer to tweet, it is at WFSU Perspective. Before we kick off today, want to thank the many, many listeners of this radio station who have expressed concern via email, telephone, and any other way they could make their thoughts and feelings known. Concern for our esteemed and longtime Morning Edition host, Ronald J. Eben. When he opened the mic at about 4 minutes after six this morning, it was readily apparent to anyone who was listening that there was something wrong. And indeed, Ron was having a medical episode. We managed to get him to Tallahassee Memorial, and the EMTs could not have been nicer about getting him out of here in a timely fashion and over there. Heard from him. We seem to be like ships crossing in the night here. He left me a voicemail message shortly after 9:30 this morning from the ER room where they had him, undergoing some tests. No evidence initially, at least, of a stroke or anything major like that. But they want to be safe rather than sorry, and they'll be doing additional testing. We will keep you folks posted as we go throughout the day. But again, thanks to everyone who expressed concern about that. Well, let's get into some other kinds of history here this morning on Perspectives. Whether you maybe come from the Jacksonville area, which is otherwise known as Duval County, they are all one and the same. The largest metro area in the United States happens to be right along those county boundaries out there. Or you go driving down Duval Street here in Tallahassee, or perhaps you stay at the Hotel Duval, or any other of a number of places named after this guy. You may not realize who this guy is, and he happens to be the territorial governor of Florida. And there is a definitive biography of him, of William Pope Duval, called Florida Founder William P. Duval, Florida Frontier Bon Vivant. And the author is the gentleman we're going to be talking to today, along with some folks in studio, who is Bob Holliday, no stranger to these microphones. Good to see you, Bob.
Good to be here again. I love this place.
I can tell you're becoming a regular here. And you brought a friend, too, David Proctor, who's the head of the history department at Tallahassee Community College, from whence both of you guys come. David, good to have you here, too.
Thank you, Tom, for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here.
And joining us on phone, the aforementioned author of Florida Founder William P. Duval, Frontier, Bon Vivant, James Michael Denham, professor of history and director of the Lawton M. Childs Jr. Center for Florida History at Florida Southern College in Lakeland. Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and I'm delighted to be able to be with Bob and my old graduate school friend and colleague, David Proctor. I really am proud for him to be involved in this today.
Well, we're so glad we could kind of arrange a grand and glorious reunion for you guys. But tell me what you – this is not, you know, your first excursion into Florida history. Talk first about some of the other books that you've written and what led you to focus on this particular historical character.
Sure, I'd like to do that. I first became associated – or not associated, but knowledgeable about William Pope Duval in my graduate school program at Florida State. And I wrote my PhD dissertation on the history of crime and punishment in antebellum Florida. And I went to many, many different courthouses all over the state that were in counties that existed before the Civil War. There were probably about 12 or more. And but, of course, in the process of doing that book and reading more about the territory in antebellum era of Florida, one of the people that, of course, was the most important people that really kind of created the territory was William Pope Duval, who was appointed territorial governor in 1822. And I'd always thought about him as a possible subject, And through the course of my time getting through graduate school and publishing that first book, finally in 1997, I worked on some other materials related to Antebellum Florida, including a book on Florida sheriffs that I was able to write with my wonderful mentor, who was an inspiration to me, William Rogers, Bill Rogers, who many of your listeners will know very, very well. So this kind of matured into a 23-year-long project that is a biography of Duval, and that's about how long it took me, writing in various brief periods or stints. You know, as I mentioned before, I guess I wrote the first word of the book probably about 10 years ago, and I was writing really seriously at that time. So it's been a long odyssey, but it's been a lot of fun, and it's really fun to have the book out finally.
Well, one of the first things that I learned about Florida when my wife and I moved down here for a radio job, of all things, way back in 1979, was that Florida Territorial Governor William Duval in 1824 was responsible for dispatching two riders, one from the settlement of St. Augustine and the other from Pensacola, and they met under a waterfall in what was to become Tallahassee, blah, 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 blah. And if we know anything about Duval, that's probably just about all we know. You go into a lot more exhaustive background and follow-up on this particular guy, and right. He didn't just start Tallahassee. This guy was a ball of fire when it came to personality and some of the other things that he did.
Well, like everything with regard to Duval, there's always the basic facts, but there's always a lot more complications in it. And that story that you've talked about, it's the same thing. When John Williams and I think it was William Simmons came from those two different destinations, they really knew where they were going. They already knew where they were going. They knew a little bit about the place, the land, the richness of the land, the soil. And they essentially kind of coalesced around the present-day location of Tallahassee, which was an old Indian settlement, and had been so for many years, and of course was the old Spanish center of the missions back in the 1600s. So they really knew where they were going, and hopefully I tell that story as part of the founding of Tallahassee, which is one of the things in the book I'm really kind of proud of. And one of the many things that Duval was instrumental in doing and overseeing. While he didn't found the city of Tallahassee, he certainly oversaw its building and was instrumental in the eventual place that it was founded. And that's really kind of the beginning of the Florida life, I guess you'd say, of the book, which is really kind of late in the book. I guess it's about a third of the way through the book, because Duval had a really interesting life even before he came to Florida, and that was something that I knew nothing about, and I had to kind of uncover that.
Let me throw this over to our guys in the studio, Bob Holliday and David Proctor, to do a little bit of scene setting as to what the North Florida territory of that time period was really like. You already said the two riders who met in Tallahassee kind of knew where the heck they were going. And so I think a lot of people think this was an uncharted, totally unpopulated wilderness area. But it really wasn't, was it?
Middle Florida was fairly unpopulated, I think. The emphases were on East and West Florida. East Florida, where the capital was St. Augustine. West Florida, where the capital was was Pensacola. And really the key, I guess, to early Florida history is sort of filling in the area in between, particularly the area between the two rivers, the Suwannee and the Apalachicola River. And, you know, we get caught up, I guess, in 20th century history and so forth, but Middle Florida in the period we are talking about, roughly from 1821 when Florida is bought from Spain, on through the antebellum period, is one of the centers of the Cotton Kingdom. I mean, Leon County will become one of the highest cotton-producing counties and slave counties in the Old South. And I mean, you and I have talked about this before. If you've ever seen a copy of Clifton Paisley's book, he's got a map of all the plantations in Leon County, and it's pretty thick.
Well, I think you're right, Bob. And one thing I like to add is you're coming out of a period where North Florida was very wild and very thinly populated. I mean, there were Native Americans who had migrated here, fleeing the settlement of the Carolinas and so on, who will eventually become the Seminoles and escape slaves. But there was a lot of wild land. What I like to add in was the longleaf pine ecosystem of the Red Hills. It's different than South Florida. And you had the Red Clay Hills with these enormous longleaf pines that had been here for generations, perhaps 300 years or so, and almost none of that is left. But the landscape, you may drive around, you know, wild forests today or go to parks, but you're not really seeing what those first settlers would have seen, those first plantation owners, and what the Native Americans in their villages were seeing. Fires would burn through northern this region and leave wiregrass and longleaf pine with hardwoods in the lower ground. But it was very rich soil. It was wonderful for cotton. But the vistas must have been amazing to see these cathedral-like longleaf pines, and that's what the planters are coming into. So you've got the best timber in the world and the red clay soil, and they're just – these planters just are brimming with energy, and they see dollar signs with the cotton trade and wealth and just the energy to do that. But I like to – in setting the scene, I like for our listeners to realize that the whole natural appearance was just different than what you see now. Even when you think you're out in the woods today, you're really in something that's been changed.
Yeah, and you can even look at pictures that date back to, say, the late 1800s of Tallahassee-Leon County, and the landscape, although abundant foliage, does not look like the foliage that we see out there today. So that it's been a changing kind of landscape ever since.
It has, and it was pretty constant under, you know, with the Native Americans. They would fire the forest, and they didn't really build heavily. But ever since the arrival of the white man, it's been an ongoing change. And every decade, every couple of decades, it looks different.
Florida history, specifically the era of William Pope Duval, Florida's first territorial governor, is what we're talking about here on Perspectives. And we want to hear from you at 414-1234 or 800-926-8809. We'll be right back. That old song, Don't Know Much About History, does not apply this morning here on Perspectives. We're talking Florida history, early Florida history, when it was a territory back in the days of William P. Duval and the man who literally wrote the book on that particular personage, James Michael Denham, professor of history and director of the Lawton M. Childs Jr. Center for Florida History at Florida Southern College in Lakeland, is on the phone. And in studio, Bob Holliday and David Proctor, both professors in the Department of History at Tallahassee Community College. And we are joined on the line by Chauncey, who is a model of patience. Hey, Chauncey, thanks for hanging on. Welcome to Perspectives.
Hi, Chauncey. First thing I want to say is that the book sounds absolutely fascinating, and I'd like to congratulate the author for having his book published.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
The second question is, I just learned about this relatively recently, and my son attends a community college down south. And he told me that history is no longer a required subject for undergraduates. And I find that a bit striking, I guess, to say the least. And I'd just like to have your feedback, and it could be anybody.
I'm sure I equally deplore this issue, no question about it, but I'm going to defer to my colleague David Proctor, because he is really, I think, far more in tune with this issue and is, I'm sure, has some important things to say.
Okay, David Proctor, go for it.
Oh, thank you, Mike. Yes, I'd love to speak to that. There's a long history behind the history requirement, which I need to keep short. But traditionally, when the community colleges were expanded after World War II, it was very common, very widespread to have a two-semester sequence. Either Western Civ was popular early, then World History and American History. But it was very common all over the state with the community colleges and the state universities too. When I went to FSU in the fall of 1980, you had to have the – they were still on quarters, but you had to have the equivalent of two semesters of history. That lasted a long time until about the late 90s. The legislature shrunk the size of the gen ed down to the current 60 hours, and other pressures developed about other courses and other social sciences and the emphasis on STEM and everything else. But to make a very complex story as short as possible, history requirements have been slowly fading out. It's not a black and white one-stroke deal, but between the decade of the 90s and then on into today, you've been ending up with most community colleges having a basket of social science courses, and you may have to take 6 hours or 9 credit hours, you know, 2 or 3 classes. But for most of them now, history is not required. It's simply an option. When I taught at North Florida Community College, it was always 6 hours. When I've taught at TCC, now going on 12 years, it was always 2 semesters of history. And it had been that since 1966 when TCC started. So basically, due to changes by the legislature, pressures on administrators and college presidents to emphasize different subjects, what has evolved is of the 28 colleges, you're down to just 7 that require 1 history course. And the other ones, it's just an option to satisfy social science. You don't have to take history at the basically the other 21. You can if you want, and that's just different from the past where you couldn't graduate without a solid 2-semester sequence in history. And I think that's just really a tragedy. It's, you know, not anyone's particular fault. It's pressures for other subjects and pressures of cost and so on. But you only have to take one look at our politics today to realize that it would be really nice if people had a stronger background in history. And the community colleges are where you can reach that, where you can reach a lot of people and get a basic history understanding.
Well, I want to come back around to our author, Mike Denham, on this.
I can agree with that. I couldn't have said it any more eloquently. But, you know, it's certainly history is in retreat. College history is increasingly diminished in terms of its significance as an important element of a broad education. On the other hand, history is very controversial. There's a lot of political conflict about it. It's difficult. It's hard. It's complicated. And unfortunately, the solution these days to complications and political controversy is just to kind of, well, ignore it. And I think there's part of that too. Plus, there's the drive increasingly towards vocationalization of college curriculum. And, you know, if it's not going to get you a job tomorrow, we might as well just junk it. That combined with the fact that, it's very difficult. And, it's not just, of course, the memorization of facts and so forth, but again, it's deplorable. I'm not sure exactly what we can do about it, other than people like your caller basically voicing indignation and challenging their legislators to do something about it.
Well, one of the things
responsible.
One of the things that I tell my students at the beginning of every semester, and I talk about the importance of history to my classes, but one of the things that I emphasize is that the study of history teaches us that not everything in our lives is ultimate. You know, we always think that the rise of someone like Donald Trump is unique, that nothing like this has ever happened before. And history, I think, teaches nuance, teaches ambiguity, and this is a cultural problem, I think, because we are reaching the point in this culture anyway to where we cannot deal with ambiguity, with nuance, to where we just vilify or blindly accept without any question at all. I mean, if you want to understand somebody like Donald Trump, study William Pope Duval.
Well, let's make some of those connections here because we really haven't gotten into this sort of personality here. And Mike Denham, if you can talk a little bit about, number one, how does a guy who was born in Richmond, Virginia, and then settles in the Kentucky frontier get appointed by the President of the United States to go to a godforsaken place like Middle Florida and kind of take over the reins of power here? How did that happen?
Well, the easy answer to it is he was connected. He was a scion, and I titled one of my opening chapters Scion of the Old Dominion, which is to say he was also of the Virginia dynasty, and we all know that the first four out of five presidents were Virginians. And Duval was connected. His father was mayor of Richmond. His father was a American Revolutionary War hero. He was connected to Washington. Duval was even distantly related to Washington. I haven't been able to go that far, that complicated, but a lot of genealogists would be able to tie that in. But anyway, he was very much a kid born with a silver spoon in his mouth, which is not to say that at a very young age he basically took the initiative, I'm sure prodding by his father, to move to Kentucky as almost a preteen, not even quite a teenager. And the myth that Washington Irving, of course, established, or at least put out, was, and Duval himself put out, is that he ran away from home, from Richmond, and went to the wilds of Kentucky to hunt bear and make his fortune on his own, with his own two feet. Well, that's not exactly so. He had lots of support. He had lots of opportunities, lots of benefits that other people didn't have. And suffice it to say that he became a great success in Kentucky. He moved to Bardstown. He read law. He became a lawyer. He got himself elected to Congress. He fought in the War of 1812. And along the way, he met all kinds of people that could do him big favors. And he was in that Congress, for example, that during the War of 1812 when Washington burned. And so he met great friends there who helped him, including John C. Calhoun, who got him kind of a lifeline after he'd gone broke in one of the depressions in Kentucky. Got him a job as a judge, a federal judge, in this new territory that we call Florida. And he first came to Florida as a territorial judge, or U.S. district judge, in St. Augustine. And within a year, he had himself appointed governor after Andrew Jackson had left the territory after only a few months in Pensacola. So he goes first to Pensacola, and then he ends up in St. Augustine, and then that kind of takes us to 1824, I guess, when we begin this. But it was all due to political connections. He was extremely well connected, both Virginia and Kentucky and other states as well.
And obviously the federal government saw, as Bob Holliday pointed out, some dollar signs floating in the air that this Florida territory would go on to become a major revenue producer for a lot of people. And so this was really quite a plum position for Mr. Duval.
Another story in this book really is, I think, the first introduction or the nationalization of Florida, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. Duval was really a kind of advance agent who promoted Florida, promoted the potential wealth of the Red Hills and Middle Florida, and really that's why the territorial capital was placed, as much as any reason else, as David mentions, because of the incredible potential of this land, and of course the territory surrounding the territorial capital. And Duval had national contacts. He had national contacts, for example, with the Marquis de Lafayette. The Marquis de Lafayette, that was, of course, instrumental in publicizing the area, and Duval was very much in contact with him throughout the 1820s. And he was also someone who had lots of connections in Virginia and Maryland, and knew all of the very well-to-do people who ended up coming down here, like the Randall family, the Wirt family. William Wirt, of course, Attorney General of the United States, didn't come himself, but he invested heavily in cotton lands in Jefferson County, and his sons and daughters. The Randolph family, for example, whose plantation encompassed the present area of Mission San Luis. Duval's daughter married one of his sons. So they really, he was in Washington really as much as he was in the territory, and promoting the territory, making contact with individuals all over the country.
One of the things,
Florida.
One of the things I like best about Duval is that he was right in the middle of what I call the sort of golden age of American myth-making. This was also the era of
yes.
Davy Crockett,
yes.
The myth of Davy Crockett, the myth of Andrew Jackson and the common man and so forth. And a lot of these people portrayed images. I happen to bring a copy of Washington Irving's one of his last books, Wolfert's Roost, which is a collection of early magazine articles he did for the Knickerbocker magazine. Washington Irving,
kind of like short stories.
Yeah, short stories, was friends with Duval, and so a lot of these are based upon Duval and help sort of build that myth and so forth. And it is important.
Well, and David Proctor, that is one of the great American mythologies that we even see reflected in some of the political discourse of today. The independent, the self-made,
yeah.
mighty American who has taken on the frontier and comes out the other side as an entrepreneur, as a mover
yeah.
and a shaker. And this is the American dream, in summary.
Tom, it really is, and it's just the core of our whole culture that you make it on your own. You go out on the frontier and carve out a farm and timber and build and self-reliance. And all those can be very important and very practical and very beneficial ideas. However, you have that ancient, that sort of old American mythology, but as you move into the 21st century, look at the complexity of the world economy. You're not really out cutting down longleaf pines and building the log cabin. You're facing competition from China. And so I think the challenge here and why knowledge of history is so important is we can understand our heritage and know why we believe these things and see the value in them. But it gives us the perspective to realize that the past can inform the present. But today is not the world of Davy Crockett. It's not the world of William Pope Duval. But there are lessons from that world in helping us to understand the one we're in today. But the self-reliance and the hard work and all that are terrific, but it's a complicated world. You've got competition from China. You've got free trade. You've got fossil fuels and climate change. And it's just the level of complexity compared to William P. Duval's world is quite a bit more. And so we should use that knowledge to understand the present, but just blindly clinging to myths and traditions and that sort of thing is not really going to help us grasp the complex problems that we face today.
Let's get some info from George, who's giving us a call here on Perspectives. Hi, George. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. You know, I think it's very sad that these students are not taking history courses. I remember, you know, going back to high school when I took, in my sophomore year, took a course called World Cultures, which went at from everything from the Greeks to the Romans, you know, early man, to China and what it is, you know, of course, what it was at that time. And then even when I was in college, you know, taking a history of the Near and Middle East and American history and a bunch of history of modern Germany. I think it's sad that people don't get the exposure to that we did. And, you know, even us, of course, you're about my age, Tom. I guess we shouldn't be blabbing out each other's secrets, but, you know, we got to witness unfortunately, the assassination of JFK and Robert and MLK and the landing on the moon, or the various moon landings and such. And it's sad that people are not going to get exposed to that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I see nods of affirmation all around the table here, George, that it's the old, you know, he who does not know history is bound to repeat it, et cetera. It's been said 85 billion times. But there is certainly an element of truth in that, because nothing new is really new when it comes to this long chain of historical events that that we ignore at our own peril.
I'd like to thank George for that, and I really agree with that. And I'd also like to add, with my friend David, I agree with David's comments. But one of the things that I think this book and this biography brings out is the ambiguities and the complexities of the world that William Pope Duval operated under. I mean, he was a guy that had to deal with all of these different issues, Indian affairs, constructing the territory, finances, road building, canal building, protecting the territory from all kinds of issues. And one of the things that that is interesting when you do a project like this is that you soon begin to understand that the people that we study in the past or read about in the past have the same kind of ambiguities and problems that we have. We sometimes forget that history is just as complicated as the present, and these people face complications in their own way that are just as vexing as we have. And I haven't even mentioned family life.
We'll get onto that on the other side of the break, if you could, Mike. Hang on the line, and we'll continue the conversation in just a moment. We're coming up on a mandatory timeout here on Perspectives. In the meantime, Inade, you hang on the line, and you'll be joining the conversation next when we roll on. If you would like to hop aboard, 414-1234 or 800-926-8809, perspectives@wfsu.org, the email, and we shall return. Back on Perspectives, talking about the history of William Pope Duval, Florida's first territorial governor, and the man with whom Tallahassee would not have been necessary, or at least possible, and the author of the new biography on William Duval, James Mike Denham, professor of history and director of the Lawton M. Childs Jr. Center for Florida History at Florida Southern College in Lakeland, with us along with Tallahassee Community College history professors, department head David Proctor, and Professor Bob Holliday. Got an email here before we roll on. Caller wants to know the proper pronunciation of Duval, since it's Duval. What's the definitive pronunciation, Bob?
Well, the pronunciation, I'm not sure. We didn't really, we weren't able to record anyone back then. Of course, the other pronunciation could be Duval, rather than Duval. We say Duval, but I really don't know the answer to that. But I can say that I had a real decision to make when I wrote this book, because most spellings of Duval, of course, just D-U-V-A-L, little l, but I soon discovered after reading Governor Duval's letters that he always made an uppercase on the V. So I decided to go with that, and I think that's a truer representation of the way that he spelled his own name. So you see in the newspapers, you see two L's on the end. You see Duval usually spelled without the big V there. But I don't know the proper – to be honest with you, I just don't know.
And the family's etymology is what, a French family, Mike?
Yes. Duval was a Huguenot family. His first descendant or his descendant, the first Duval to come to America was his grandfather, his great-grandfather, who came in around 1700 from France. As part of, like many other Huguenots who came to the colonies, the English colonies.
So perhaps the French pronunciation then would be more apropos.
Perhaps.
But, yeah. Mm-hmm. But hard to tell. Let's go to line four. Speaking of multiple cultures and diversities, Inade, I believe, is the pronunciation. Did I get that right, Inade?
It's Inada. It's Spanish.
Inada. Okay.
Inada, yes, correct.
Thank you very much for calling. Go right ahead.
Okay, I have a question. Since I'm a Native American, I'm interested in knowing more specifically about the peaceful relationship or the peaceful dealings that Duval or Duval had with the Native people. Can he amplify that a bit?
Sure, yeah. Go ahead, Mike.
Sure. As territorial governor of Florida, William Pope Duval was ex officio, automatically became ex officio head of Indian Affairs. He was he controlled the militia, and also he was the federal government's immediate contact with the Native Americans. And eventually, there would be an Indian agent that was appointed. But Duval's first relationship with the Native Americans, of course, was right there in Tallahassee, and his counterpart there was an Indian by the name of Niemalta. Niemalta was really a kind of a larger than life figure who dominated his peoples. He was a Red Stick Creek who had come from Alabama after the War of 1812, when the Creeks were flushed out of Alabama. As he came to Florida as a refugee after the Creek War and Battle of Horseshoe Bend. And he basically resided in the territory that eventually became Tallahassee. And Duval had kind of a love-hate relationship with him. They got along pretty well, but of course they had a lot of stormy problems. And in the the Treaty of Moultrie Creek, which actually is over in St. Augustine, he represented the Indian bands around Tallahassee, and there were many other bands, of course, who were also represented at that conference in 1823. And under the agreement, the Seminole Indians agreed to go to a reservation in the lower part of the state. During that time, there were lots of conflicts, and eventually Duval and Niemalta had a kind of a confrontation, which once again was mythologized to a certain extent by Washington Irving and Duval's own tall tales about a confrontation they had in the Tallahassee area. Suffice it to say that Duval ousted Niemalta from leadership of the tribe, and it replaced him with someone else. But I want to go on and emphasize that after the Indian Agency was created in around Fort King, which is present-day Ocala, Duval was responsible for negotiating the boundaries, or making sure the boundaries were intact. And there was lots of confrontation between the whites and the blacks, and, of course, the whites and the Indians. And, of course, the big issue was slaves held by Indians, either as slaves or as family members, really. And there were lots and lots of confrontations and lots of legal battles, which occurred in the Alachua County area. And he was determined that the Indians, of course, get a fair shake. In fact, the titles of my chapter is Trials and Tribulations and what Duval called left-handed justice. And suffice it to say that he was very strident in his opposition to the behavior of the courts, in terms of treating Indians fairly. I was trying to find a quote in the book, but I can't find it right this second. But this subject is very well, and the complexities of this subject is very well discussed in the book and very thoroughly discussed in the book. And I'm proud to say that I think it's one of the best places we can go to look at this issue, really, in the first couple of decades of the Florida territory.
Well, Bob Holliday and David Proctor, these were very complex times anyway, right, for the relationships.
That's a very long-winded answer. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's good, but I wanted to get your colleagues in here too, Mike, to talk a little bit about the intricacies of some of these relationships, because, again, with so many years gone by, it's so easy to say, well, here were the good guys, here were the bad guys, and that's right. Just the way it was, but it was far more complex than that.
Well, there were all sorts of reasons why Andrew Jackson and his acolytes, I guess, wanted to get the Seminoles out of Florida ultimately. One of them, of course, was land. Another one, of course, was the fact that Florida was, at least under the Spanish, was free territory and escaped slaves. If you're in Georgia, you know, let's go to Florida and so forth. And that's all sorts of pressure and so forth.
intersection of slavery and Indian relations and frankly market capitalism, or at least an early form of market capitalism. I want to ask Mike to expound a little bit on Duvall and slavery and his role in the whole slavery controversy.
Duvall is a politician, as a statesman, as a person who lived in until 1854, both in and out of politics, was a great supporter of slavery and slavery expansion. And of course, the major issue of the 1840s and 50s, when Duvall was becoming an old man, was expansion of slavery in the territories. He was a great advocate of slavery. He never owned that many slaves himself. His father owned quite a few. His father emancipated all of his slaves. But remember, his father was of the generation of George Washington, which was a kind of period of voluntary emancipation by many of the generation of the founding fathers. But as Duvall matured, he became convinced that the South was the advancement of the South, the prosperity of the South, that the growth of the South, that the economic future of the South would be based on, would be based on antebellum slavery. On the other hand, Duvall was known to mentor and, I guess you'd say, kind of protect numerous individuals who found themselves in this condition. In fact, there's a couple of instances in the book that I talk about that where Duvall befriended. Of course, many of your listeners will know about the Proctor family. He was associated with the Proctors who migrated to Tallahassee, and some of the first migrations from St. Augustine to Tallahassee. And he was protector of young Proctor, and Proctor had known or Duvall had known Proctor's father in St. Augustine, and was a very instrumental part of his Indian affairs and Indian communications. So anyway, it's a very ambiguous legacy. It's not a positive legacy when it comes to certainly this subject in American history. But Duvall was very much a man of his times in that regard. He was certain that slavery, of course, was, at least in his generation, would be the issue around which the South would advance.
And that leads us to, again, a reconsideration of so many people in history, viewed now through a more contemporary lens, when we just had this discussion in the Florida legislature about should the statue of a Confederate general remain in the U.S. Capitol as a representative of Florida's history, or should that person be replaced with someone who doesn't have quite as onerous a background? Could the same thing happen to Duvall, given his proclivities when it comes to that whole issue of slavery? Guys, what do you think?
Well, history is an interpretive discipline more than almost anything I can think of, I suppose. I mean, one of the things that just makes my hair stand up on end is when people talk about, we've got to, rein in the teaching of history and things like that. We've got to control the teaching of history. I mean, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this. There is a perhaps apocryphal story, I'll put it this way, about when the gen ed standards were coming up before the legislature, and one of the legislators, who shall go nameless, don't know his name, apparently said to someone else, well, we can't be having none of this liberal history anymore. And, I don't know whether that's true or not, but history is controversial by its nature. It's interpretive by its nature. I tell my students every semester that David Proctor and I can teach the same class right down the hall from each other, and we can have a 180-degree different take on things. And history, by nature, fosters disagreement and critical thinking and interpretation. And
That's great, Bob. That goes right back to my earlier idea, and that is, why should we think that history and the things that happened in the past are any less controversial or any less ambiguous or any less complicated than the present.
Right.
I mean, these people are human beings. They deal with these ambiguities every day. Just getting up out of bed is a real controversy sometimes. But having to deal with families and political connections and, you know, and ambitions about, you know, aspiring to things, getting rich, being afraid to get put to lose your money, all of these are human conditions that every society deals with.
Yeah.
And so it's complicated stuff, and sometimes it's really unhappy, and sometimes it's depressing.
It really is, Mike and Bob, those are so true. I think it just speaks to why we need history requirements and why we need to work students through these stories. If you look at all the issues, Tom, you just brought up about Kirby Smith and the larger issue of statues in Nathan Bedford Forrest and all over the South, what are you going to do with all this? What I would say, a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. It's probably a good idea to learn your history and take all these monuments and street names and everything else and, of course, decide. But the best thing to do is not to wipe it all clean. Put up explanatory plaques. Create some information around the statue, the entire story, and not just who the person
right.
was, but why was he put here? You know, why was there a monument in New Orleans to the Battle of Liberty Place instead of just an obelisk that says, wow, there was a battle? It's important for us as historians and the informed public to realize, and I know this from teaching freshmen community college students since the 80s, there's just a vast ocean of ignorance and lack of knowledge. People are not dumb. These students are very smart. But the culture of entertainment, the changing emphasis in education has just created a generation that really doesn't know. And people like us on this program, we're all in a bubble. We are all talking about William P. Duvall, and he's fascinating and colorful. I know from teaching, and Bob does too, and you do too, Mike, that whole vast majorities of people out there don't know any of this. And it is challenging, it's hard, and it can become boring if it's not taught right.
But it's ultimately destructive to the culture not to.
To not know it. But if we don't know it, we can't make really sensible decisions. You have people thinking that everything just snapped into existence when they were born, you know. And that may sound crazy and head-shaking to us on this program and probably to our listeners who I'm sure are engaged and interested. But our challenge is how to tell these stories. William Duvall is a fascinating, colorful character. And in the hands of a good history teacher in Florida, he can be used to engage students to tell them there's a long past from Andrew Jackson to Rick Scott, full of colorful characters, Claude Kirks and Napoleon Bonaparte Broward, and just on. And when this is integrated closely into our curriculum and taught by engaging students, we grow citizens who know history and can think about the present and not go wildly off following this demagogue or that demagogue or wanting to rip this statue down or that, because they're not thinking about it deeply. Knowledge of history enables thoughtful citizenship, and none of today's problems have a chance of being solved if everybody's just yelling and screaming and nobody knows the past and it's just whoever's convincing, you know, whatever tribal group is all thinking the same thing instead of good rational understanding. So I know I'm not speaking in sound bites, but that's really the truth. And I hope all our listeners will, if you know legislators or the governor or college presidents or college administrators, just tell them we really need a solid history requirement. And in the hands of good teachers, it can build good citizenships. And things don't have to turn into liberal, conservative, my tribe versus your tribe, but thoughtful citizens who can engage each other and come up with good solutions.
And if you want to get started on a great exploration of a lot of the history that led to where we are in Florida today, can't recommend anything more highly than a gander at Florida founder William P. Duvall. Frontier Bon Vivant by James Michael Denham, who is the professor of history and director of the Lawton M. Childs Jr. Center for Florida History at Florida Southern College in Lakeland. Thanks for joining us, Mike. Enjoyed it.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it, too.
Good to talk to you again, Mike.
And our TCC professors, Bob Holliday and David Proctor, thanks for coming in, guys.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
So enjoyed being here.
David.
Perspectives produced by WFSU-FM in Tallahassee. Technical assistance by Taylor Cox. With Lydell Rawls on the phones and email, I'm Tom Flanagan. Last week we talked about the bees. Next week's perspective, we'll talk about the birds. Local birders talking about their hobby and how critical a healthy bird population is to all of us. That's coming up next week right here on Perspectives.
Copies of Perspectives are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. Log on to WFSU.org for online archives and podcast. Perspectives is a production of 88.9 WFSU-FM, Tallahassee.